I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is actor, producer, and director Neil Patrick Harris. And now, join Marcy Glazer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Neil Patrick Harris.
Neil Patrick Harris is an accomplished author, actor, producer, director, host, prestidigitator, rapscallion, and father of twins. The first book in his Magic Misfits series spent 12 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and was called Enchanting by Entertainment Weekly. On television, he is best known for playing medical wunderkind Doogie Howser, M.D., back in my days, Barney Stinson on How I Met Your Mother, yes, for which he was nominated for 4 Emmy Awards, and currently Count Olaf on A Series of Unfortunate Events. He is also known for his role as the title character in Joss Whedon's musical Dr. Horrible's Sing-Along Blog. Yeah. On film, he has appeared in Downsizing, Gone Girl, A Million Ways to Die in the West, the Harold and Kumar series, Starship Troopers, and The Smurfs 1 and 2. In 2014, he starred in the title role in Hedwig and the Angry Inch on Broadway, for which he won the Tony Award for Best Leading Actor in a Musical. He has hosted the Tony Awards 4 times, the Emmy Awards twice, and the 87th Academy Awards in 2015. Neil served as president of the Academy of Magical Arts from 2011 to 2014. His best-selling memoir, Choose Your Own Autobiography, was released in 2014, and The Magical Misfits, The Second Story, is the second novel in his acclaimed middle grade series. Tonight, he appears in conversation with the JCCSF's own Director of Public Programs, Jordan Abel. Please join me in welcoming Neil Patrick Harris to our stage.
What's happening? Thanks for coming.
Hello.
What up?
Welcome to San Francisco, hey, Neil Patrick Harris.
Thank you so much. I was looking on my phone to see when I was last here, and I believe it was in 2012. It's been a bit.
Yeah.
But I've been here a few times and had fantastic memories of this lovely foodie town.
Yes. Clearly this is your favorite stop on the tour already.
For sure.
Right? Yeah, definitely.
100%.
Best city.
Ever.
Ever.
My husband did a play, a musical at the Magic Theater called The Opposite of Sex, based on the movie. And when we were living in LA, I would come up every weekend and hang out with him and see them. And great friends of mine live here. And I've had a lot of New Year's Eves and New Year's Day celebrations here. I barely remember them, but they were awesome. No, I love San Francisco.
Great. Well, we are so glad you're here. San Francisco loves you, obviously. I want to thank you for being here on behalf of the whole JCCSF community. Your work has meant so much to all of us here in the audience tonight and
Thanks.
Around the world. And there's so much we could talk about, but we want to focus on this amazing new book, The Magic Misfits, The Second Story, and your writing career.
Cool.
So I would love to just get right into it. Can you tell us a little bit about the series for those of us who haven't read the book yet?
Yeah, for sure. Just so that I don't know if I'm speaking out of turn, who has not read any of them at all and needs sort of like a primer on? Oh, well, that's terrible
you
news.
You did not.
Okay. Oof. Glad you're here. So The Magic Misfits is a series of books. It will be 4 books, and it's about a group of younger kids in a fictitious town called Mineral Wells, sort of an every town, And these kids each love a different type of magic, not mystical magic with wands and portals and dragons and things, but actual practical magic, coins and cards, illusion, escape, transformation, things like that. And each book follows one of the four kids as a protagonist as they realize that the things that make them feel insecure and more like a misfit and an outcast in ways, once they realize that they have this joined love of something, then through a man named Mr. Vernon, who owns the magic shop in town, and he helps them all realize that they should form a club called the Magic Misfits. In the first book, there's a carnival that's come into town, run by a large, nefarious man named B.B. Basso, who has a bunch of clown hench people called the Frown Clowns, and they don't speak, but they're sad. And they are out to steal the world's largest diamond, which is also in the town. The kids have to use their magical skill and ability and know-how to try and thwart B.B. Basso, who, as it turns out, is part of his own organization called the Emerald Ring. And they get him to go out of town. And so now, even though you may not need to buy the book, you should still fill in the gaps between the dots to connect. And so now book two follows a girl named Layla, who is the daughter of Mr. Vernon and his better half, the other Mr. Vernon. Those are her two fathers, and he is the magician. The other Mr. Vernon is a chef, cook who works at the Grand, what's it called? The Grand Oak Resort. Sort of a Catskills resort up in the mountains a little bit north in town. And then there's two other kids named Ollie and Izzy, who are twins, and they're very schmackty, borscht belt 12-year-olds that finish each other's sentences, very Gracie Allen and Burns. See, I told you backstage that my memory recall on names is not George Burns and Gracie Allen.
Yes.
That kind of banter, I'm trying to bring that back. So that's kind of the idea of the stories in general. There's four books that'll follow the four main protagonists. Carter Locke is the in book one, and then Layla Vernon's in book two. Theo Steinmeier, who's a violinist and also can make things levitate, is the protagonist in the third book that I finished writing. The fourth book, which I'm writing, is Ridley, and Ridley is wheelchair bound, but she's super kind of gruff but sweet. She's kind of the MacGyver of the group. Can sort of make anything Professor X-y a little bit. And so that's the gang. So there's four books, like the four suits and a deck of cards. The books themselves have lots of random stuff in them. There's codes to solve. There's magic tricks to learn. I do four teacher tricks within the book as kind of palate cleansers. As you go on about a quarter of the way in, you'll learn something. And that's the books in a very large nutshell.
Great, thank you.
A walnut,
you should still buy them. So a magician,
yep,
married to a chef. There's some twins.
Yeah.
Is this autobiographical at all?
Not really. I was just speaking. I mean, you write towards things that you sort of know about. And weirdly, the two kids who are the twins in the book were not at all based on my kids at all. And we were in another city, and someone asked me that, and I thought, well, that's really random. It's incredibly obvious. But while I was writing it, I just thought comic relief would be fun, and it seemed like to have that that male-female comedy dynamic seemed fun. So that's how they turned into twins.
Great.
And having a cook be... I suppose that I know a little bit about that.
All right. So you're very busy, and what was your inspiration to start writing as well? You're adding author to the list of all of the accomplishments that you have.
Well, I'm a parent, and so in being a parent, you're watching your kids grow and mature, and with that, for us, is a lot of reading. We read to them since they were first at our homes from the hospital in their cribs. We read Goodnight Moon every night to them until we memorized it, and then we just said Goodnight Moon, but it's a book in theory. But we still read to them all the time. So just reading and reading content that was for them was something that we did on the regular, which means we were constantly buying new books, judging other authors and their content. And you find that a lot of books for kids are just pretty dumb. I mean, I'm not saying mine is anything amazing. In fact, it's a middle grade book, so it's not what I'm speaking of. But some of these larger picture books, I think 50 pages, like 40 pages of nothing. Like a giraffe that goes into the city and puts on hats.
Did your kids always have the same opinion of the books that you did, or were they like, ah?
Well, we always do funny voices when we're reading them, so I think they're more amused by the performance of it all. But originally, Magic Misfits was going to be a picture book because that's the age that we were with the kids, and so I thought the simplicity of kids who like magic. Because I have strong opinions about magic. It's my hobby, and it's what I study. It's kind of what I wish I will be when I grow up, and that's also a weird art form because a lot of people either don't know much about magic, aren't exposed to much magic, or when they are, it's in a less than ideal context. And I think magic sometimes gets a bad rap. Magic in the world, in America especially, kind of shifts from being something that's cool to being something that's really cheesy. And so I feel like I have an obligation and an ability to represent magic as being something that's good, especially to a younger generation. So it was going to be a picture book with these kids that could do real simple things. If I can use my levitation skills and you can use your escape skills, we can get the cat out of the tree. Like something simple. But then our kids are getting older, and I thought, well, there's a really interesting opportunity here to teach kids who can read for themselves, and that's right where Harper and Gideon are. Gideon's the switch has flipped with him, and he gets all the words now. Even if he doesn't know the words, he can break them apart and figure out the word. Harper's right there, about to get that right. And it's just the best time. It's my favorite to see them become independent thinkers and then watch and observe them decide what they're interested in. Is this person going to stab me? Oh, no. Okay, good. You just come to sit down. Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I saw you creeping. I wasn't sure if you were going to shiv me. Thanks for coming. So Magic Misfits Book 1 is about four kids in a town called Minnesota. I'm just kidding.
So are your kids into magic?
They like magic, okay.
Yeah?
I'm resistant to show them magic because magic for young people is a little bit of an opiate. Because once they know that you can produce things out of their ear, that's kind of all they want you to do.
So
it's fun seven times, and then it's just a broken record.
Yeah. When were you first introduced to magic? What was your falling in love with magic story like?
Well, I'm old.
No.
So impossible. I got interested in magic when magic specials used to be on television, when there were very few channels. And there was a man named Doug Henning who was in the late 70s.
Doug Henning fans.
Doug Henning was this Canadian hippie magician who would wear jumpsuits and bedazzled jumpsuits, and his hair was long and dark and curly, and he had big front teeth. And he was Canadian, and everything was the wonderful world of magic. And everything was so great. And he'd hop around and go, "Hey, everybody, do this. Like, magic." He was this weird yogi guy. But he had once a year, he had a magic special that was on network television. And the big thing about the Doug Henning specials was there were no camera tricks. It was the first time, back then in television, they had to say, Gene Kelly would host the special and say, at the very beginning, the camera will not cut away. You will see one continuous shot. And that was so exciting because he did big illusions. And he would get inside a a box, and then it would get severed into lots of pieces, and then it'd open up, and he'd be gone, and he'd appear in the audience, and it would be the same camera, the same cut, and I just loved that. I loved the yearly special. And then right after Doug Henning was David Copperfield, who was very, very recognizable in doing a yearly special must-see, walking through the Great Wall of China, making the Statue of Liberty vanish, doing these great, cool vignettes of magic on stage where he'd do 7 or 8 tricks all together on almost like a theater piece. And I just loved it so much. And living in small town New Mexico where I grew up, when we would go to Albuquerque and visit my grandparents, there was a magic shop in the mall there. And it was called Fool's Paradise. And it was this great, cool magic trick shop. And that was just what I would do every time I went to Albuquerque. I'd ask to go to the mall, and I'd spend 3 hours like talking to the guy behind the magic counter, asking what this is, and can you perform this and that, and I'd save up my allowance, and I would get these tricks, and on the 3-hour trip home, I'd sit in the back seat, and I'd get to open up the packet. I still think it's just the coolest. Open up the packet and take out the piece of paper, see the little props, and then take the piece of paper, and it would say what the secret was. And you go, I know how the secret works.
What was the first magic trick that you really felt like you succeeded at?
It was a great trick called Nickels to Dimes. And essentially it's a stack of nickels, solid nickels. You can see them, they move around. And you have a little brass cap that just fits over the top of it. And you put the cap on top of the nickels. It's hollow, it's empty, you can see. You cover it, and then when you lift it up, the cap is still empty, but now the nickels are a stack of dimes.
Did you just reveal your magician secret?
No, that's the trick. You take nickels, you cover it, yeah. And then they turn into dimes.
That's amazing.
And I thought, what a great way to make money.
And here you are today.
And here I am today.
Yes, yes.
Bags of dimes. Just littered around my house.
Everywhere. So so it's so, the friendship in the book, the friendships are so powerful. And I'm wondering if when you were growing up, did you have your own band of magic misfits and friends that were significant and that helped shape you into who you are today?
I suppose so. I grew up, you know, Ruidoso, New Mexico is a pretty idyllic, little, interesting town. It's in the mountains of New Mexico. So lots of pine trees, a river that kind of runs through it. It'd be a good title for a movie. You didn't lock your doors. There was one high school, one elementary school. Everyone sort of knew each other. And I reflect now that we live in Harlem, New York, and we're in a much, much more metropolitan existence, how lucky I was and how grateful I was to have grown up in a place where we were very carefree and able to just run around. I mean, I knew how to get to friends' houses by running Hunger Games style through the woods until you saw a tree that was splintered a bit, and that's when you turned right, and then you'd jump over the thing and make a left, and that's sort of how we got around in my life. And we had a great group of friends, but I was my life took a very strange turn right when I was finishing middle school and about to go into high school. And I started acting, and that was such a unique experience, and so sort of plucked out of that world, and doing something so exciting but so random that I was sort of plucked away from a group of friends, and then we moved to Albuquerque once my brother Brian graduated high school in Ruidoso. Then we moved to Albuquerque. I was doing a TV show in LA until I graduated from high school. So that was. I was sort of uprooted. I joined another group of friends when I started doing theater, I think. Well, actually, that's not true. In Albuquerque, I was in La Cueva High School, which is super awesome, and they had a theater department there. And I had never met a group of actor people. Not, that doesn't make sense. I had never met a group of people in New Mexico who shared so many interests. And so the theater department there at high school was just the coolest. So I've met a lot of like-minded people in that world.
That's great.
But magicians are weird. As a group of people, they're kind of weird. I would, you know, arm's length, you know what I mean?
What is?
I'm just saying, like old birthday school magician, birthday party magicians, and do you think they're weird? They show up and they look weird and they do weird magic and it's kind of boring, but you have to sit there through it. I'm not into it.
Is there any?
I'm into good magic. I'm into people being better than that.
What makes magic good? In your opinion, what makes it good magic versus?
I think having a, not unlike an actor in a play, having a making a choice, having a point of view, being the bumbly magician and going at that full tilt and that being what you do and that being funny, like Carl Ballantyne or someone, or being the suave magician but doing it well, finding ways to take individual tricks and join them in ways that haven't been done before, inventing ways of doing things that haven't been done before, seeking out historical ways of doing things and bringing them back so that people haven't seen it before.
You're listening to actor, producer, director, and former president of the Academy of Magical Arts, Neil Patrick Harris, whose new book is The Magic Misfits, The Second Story. On Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
The magician is a very strange profession because it's one of the few professions that you can just decide you're going to be a professional magician, and all you have to do is spend money to do so. You can go to a magic shop, you can spend $10,000 and buy a bunch of stuff and then call yourself a magician and go do it. All you have to do is read the secrets and do the very basic version of it. And I think that gives magicians and magic not the greatest reputation. But I think magic, when done right, is so cool. And there's lots of ways to observe it now, especially with the tube of you and and with, you know, trips to cool places. I think things like Teatro Zanzani, which is here, is magical. I think when circus people are balancing on each other's heads, that seems like a magic trick to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just am a big proponent of people going and seeing things. I feel like when you go see a Broadway musical and the set turns into something else and you're in the whole other world and it's snowing and weird stuff like that, I think that's a magic trick. So that's the kind of magic I respond to.
Great. It was a very intentional choice that the magic skills and talents that you gave the characters were not, oh, I can see through things, mm-hmm. sort of things, but actual specific, things that you can practice,
mm-hmm.
Practical magic, as you called it.
Indeed.
I'm wondering if you can talk about your decision around that choice as a writer. I mean, did you always know that was what it was going to be, and what are the reasons behind it?
For sure. I'm a proper skeptic when it comes to that kind of stuff. I know enough about magic and how it works that I'm not a believer in psychics or ghosts or things like that. There's explanations for almost everything. I'm not militant about it because who am I? But from my experience, I think there's logical explanations for stuff. And so given that that's who I am, I thought that would be a cool thing to teach kids. And I think with kids learning how to do magic comes responsibility, because you have to learn how to keep the secret. That's hard for kids to do, to not want to say, you want to see a magic trick? Here's how it's done. There's a hole in the quarter. See? There's a hole in the middle of the quarter. You have to keep the secret, and that's tough. You also have to practice a lot. More than you think that you should. And that's an interesting thing for someone who's anxious to get a reaction, a positive reaction from someone else, is to do it too many times on your own and really practice it. It makes a big difference, right? And misdirection, I think, is a really cool thing that that magicians need to learn how to do, is to focus on something or to send your focus to something even though something else may be happening. If I have a quarter in my hand and I pretend to put it in this hand but I'm still keeping it in this hand, right? The misdirection is my focus then looking at this hand even though it's over here. So you don't, well, you can, but it's less effective to say, here's a quarter, which hand's it in? right? There's no misdirection there. But if you say, here's a quarter, I'm going to put it in my hand. Now, it's in this hand here. I could already do a whole kind of bunch of the stuff down here. But I think that's an interesting concept for kids to be able to learn, is focus and misdirection. So I like magic, as you can hear. And and I thought that was a cool way to get a new generation, or even a current generation, to respect it.
That's great. And as you mentioned earlier, the books are written from different characters' perspectives.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious about what it was like inhabiting the voices of these different characters and then writing the books from their different perspectives, especially how was writing from Layla's perspective different than Carter's, for example?
Well, Carter was a sort of gruff, cynical a kid, and that was my way of introducing him to Mineral Wells as a town, because he jumped on a train. He knew magic because his uncle, who he didn't really like but who he lived with, used magical skills in order to take things from people. Pickpockets, steal watches, three-card Monty, steal people's money, befriend people so that he can pick their pockets, things like that. And so that's how Carter lived, and so his impression of magic was that it was done with ill intent. And so then he can't deal with his uncle anymore, jumps on a train, and the train winds up in Mineral Wells. And he meets Mr. Vernon, the guy, the owner of the magic shop in town, and he's very sort of skeptical. And I thought that would be a good way to, for us as an audience or the reader, to get into magic is from a skeptical perspective, because then you have to sort of be won over, as opposed to liking magic. There's really nowhere to go from there. And so with that, I wanted the sentence structures to be a little nastier. I mean, not overtly so, because it's for kids, but I wanted the words to say, I didn't want to keep saying Carter said, Mr. Vernon said. I wanted it to be Carter growled, Mr. Vernon spat, you know, that he said with a shrug, you know, like something that felt like it was through the eyes of someone who was a little tougher. With book two, it's Layla's story. She was adopted and now lives with Mr. Vernon and the other Mr. Vernon, and they're a wonderful family, but she still has questions about what family means. Book one was the suit was diamonds. No, book one was hearts. Book one was diamonds, because of the diamond that's in it. In book two is clubs, because Layla's talking more interested in what a club is, what a family means, what a unit is. And in it, I wanted her sentences to be a bit more poetic, a bit more yearning, a bit more curious, just so I don't want it to feel like it's the same story told four different times, mm-hmm. but from a little bit of different perspectives.
And did you have the same routine when you were writing each book? Do you have a very regimented writerly routine, or what does that look like?
Not really. I tend to get people together that I like and throw ideas around and spitball stuff and hear things and then go off and write badly and write too much and then I'm not very precious when it comes to material. So if people have ideas that are better than mine, I will almost always honor them. Mm-hmm. And so we just kind of kept slowly whittling it down. And then once someone would say, oh, why don't you, you know, wouldn't it be cool if there was this? And then, oh, if that happens, then the dominoes start falling, and then this could be that, and this could be that. Oh, this is perfect. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go write that.
And were you writing the books in sort of 5-minute, half-hour, hour increments in between while you were doing a lot of other things, or did you set aside
a lot of time on airplanes?
Okay.
Because I was in Vancouver for the better part of the last 3 years doing the Lemony Snicket show.
Oh, just that.
And so I would fly back and forth to New York, which is a healthy flight. And I would take my time, and then all of a sudden there'd be a deadline, and then I'd have to write a lot more.
Okay.
Really fast.
Has your relationship to writing changed as you're now working on it's going to be your fifth book total, right? You're writing the fourth one, but you had the autobiography as well, so...
Yeah, less, probably just less blindly insecure about how it's going to go. And I had a lot of stresses writing the first Magic Misfits book because what I thought was going to be easy-ish, which was writing for younger people, I thought that I would be more forgiving to myself because it was for kids. But I found the opposite to be true. I found that I put more pressure on myself because these kids are reading these books for the first time and they're new readers, and so I almost felt more obligation to add more social content in a way that's palatable and doesn't feel heavy-handed, and add a sense of humor level to keep the sentences, the vocabulary high enough that it's challenging, but not too high that they will have to ask what all these words mean. But if you don't have some interesting words, then it starts to feel very Magic Treehouse. Mm-hmm. So that was challenging. Once that was done and then the blueprint was there, then books 2, 3, and 4 started falling into place easier because you've got these established people.
Do you think that you're launching into another... Are we going to see more children's books, more middle-aged books after these 4?
I don't have any plans for that.
Okay.
That's a tricky question to answer because if I say yes, it means that I'm looking to do something next. Mm-hmm. And if I say no, it sort of implies that I didn't like doing it.
Yep.
And that's not the case. It was just I got off on the idea that there aren't many book series for kids that talk about magic in this way. So I feel like I'm able to do something that I know about that could have a little bit of lasting excitement for kids in a generational kind of way, potentially, without having to stand on a soapbox that I don't feel comfortable standing on.
And you mentioned one of your children is just reading and the other isn't quite there. Have you read the book to them? Have they read the books?
David read book 1 to them while I was in Vancouver.
Okay.
And they liked it, which is awesome. And then I've been reading book 2 to them right before I started on this tour. And David's continuing. And they like it very much. And if they don't, then they're going to go away.
Yeah. Do they offer you notes?
That's how it works. No, they've been very sweet. They tell me when they think things are funny and then they like stuff, so.
That's great. One of the things that I really value about the characters in the book is that all of the Magic Misfits come from very different backgrounds. They've experienced some challenging things in their lives. You don't shy away from those sorts of things. Layla often has nightmares. And I'm just curious, was it hard for you to imagine and write those backstories? And can you tell us why it was so important for you to create the characters with such a wide array of life experiences?
Well, my assumption is that if middle grade readers are reading, that they need to have something to attach themselves to. There needs to be some part of the book that they recognize within themselves. So that's why Mineral Wells is in every town that doesn't really exist anywhere, because I thought if it took place in a Cape Cod-y sort of specific town, if you lived in New Mexico, you might not quite feel like you'd get it. And if it was set in a city and you lived in the country, you wouldn't quite get it. So I tried to create a every town. And then within the characters, I just wanted to make sure I was representing well. I'm a white male, so I didn't want to have just a bunch of white kids. But I also didn't want to be annoying about it. I wanted to make sure everyone's represented well and that the inclusive diversity within the characters is just the way it is. It's not something that is focused on. So Layla has 2 dads, which I know a thing or two about, but I didn't feel like that's something that needs to then be talked about. I didn't feel like then someone's supposed to ask in the book what's that about, and then they're supposed to talk about it. It just is, as a point of fact. Mm-hmm. Thanks. So, Ridley's wheelchair bound, but again, she doesn't want any sympathy for that. So I just thought that, again, that's an interesting opportunity. I don't know. I struggle with that. I struggle with the idea sometimes, if I'm being honest, about when you're celebrity-ish and you're an actor, where your responsibility lies. Because we live, especially right now, in a political and social climate that is so polarizing and shocking, and it just feels like everyone should speak out. At the same time, I'm the guy from Doogie Howser and the Smurfs. So it's like I value that what I am in this Game of Thrones is a court jester, you know? I'm not a scholar. I know things, I've learned things, I have wisdom about things that are important to me, but to someone who doesn't know me, it might feel a little inauthentic. So I feel like it's not my place to talk about things that may be important to me. I feel like it's my place to represent in a very sort of regular way to me. So my husband and I have our kids, we live our lives, we're not trying to do anything. And so I thought, weirdly, with the books, that's an opportunity to actually say some things in a subtle-ish kind of way so that I can add a level of acceptance without having to feel like I'm preaching. I'm not into that. It's not my thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why I opted for this kind of book.
Yeah.
That's why my autobiography was a choose-your-own autobiography. So if you want to know about drinking scotch and wearing suits and playing laser tag, you can go to page 81. If you really like the gay stuff, go to page 147. But I could let you choose your own path to my life, you know?
Yeah, well, and...
By the way, the gay stuff is great in the book.
In this book, this group of friends is joining forces through their love of magic to right rights, foil the villainous, and protect those who need it. It seems like certainly those are qualities we need now more than ever. And I'm curious about what kind of advice you give your kids, how you talk to your kids about those things, or what advice you might give people in the audience tonight about doing those things, making the world better.
I just feel like, if anything, I believe in karma. I feel like when you make good choices, then good choices tend to come to you. And conversely, if you know that there's a good choice to be had and you make a bad choice, it somehow, some kind of way, kind of bites you in the butt, and it happens in that way. It may not be super overt, and it may not be true, but that's just kind of what I believe. And I think that it's a good thing to make good choices. We have the opportunity all the time to just make choices that are a good choice. Hold the door open for someone. Let someone else out of the elevator first. Walk an old lady across the street. I mean, some of them are very old and simple. Call your parents. Hug your kids. Like, I just think you can make good choices. Put your phone down. I think that those are simple things that anyone can kind of agree to. And that's what we talk to our kids about a lot. Is, you know, throughout your day, throughout school... in interactions between the two of them, you can word yourself in a way that's effective. You can make the good choice to say, hey, Harper, your iPad game looks a lot more fun than mine. When you're done playing yours, playing that round, can I take a turn? You're more likely to get a yes reaction than, I want that, give me that, let me have that, I want that, right? So I don't know, that's kind of where I feel like... As an adult, I can speak to kids.
Great.
At least mine.
Well, thank you so much. I want to make sure we have plenty of time for audience questions.
Word.
So we are going to move
literally.
To that.
Is it the question and answer part of the show right now?
It is.
This is so exciting.
Yes.
Hi. My question is along the lines of the variety of backgrounds. How did you create a... appropriate representation, an accurate representation of these people who don't look like you or have had different life experiences than you have had?
That's a great question. Well, I mean, I've lived a lot of chapters with a lot of different people, and I've been around and hung out with all kinds of different people in my own life. So even though I am a specific type of person, I've certainly have spent a lot of time with other types of people as well. So I didn't feel like I was fraudulent or fictionalizing any types of ways. At the same time, it's intentional. It's a simpler type of book, so I didn't put a lot of pressure on that. I just wanted to make sure that people were represented well, but also as regular people. So I didn't want to make anyone seem better or worse than in any way. I just wanted everyone to feel like they were welcome and included.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is actor, producer, director, and former president of the Academy of Magical Arts, Neil Patrick Harris, whose new book is The Magic Misfits, The Second Story. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
What's your name?
Miley.
Miley?
Uh-huh.
It's so nice to meet. How old are you?
9.
Is it weird to hear your voice amplified in the speakers? Who are you next to? What's your sister's name?
Lauren.
Lauren? Oh my gosh, you guys are so beautiful. What's your question?
Are any of the characters you made up based on people in reality?
That's a very, very good question. I'm trying to think. Well, there's aspects of all of the characters that I'm familiar with, but I'm probably most familiar with Carter in the first book. I kind of thought I was a bit of a skeptic. I didn't live with an uncle and ride on trains, but I liked the way he sort of processed information. And I kind of always yearned for a Mr. Vernon type person in my life that was that teacher that would give you, that you could ask questions to and would not just give you the answer, but would answer your question with another question and sort of a gleam in their eye where you knew that they were tapping you towards the right solution, that you had to solve it on your own. So I kind of wished that I knew a Mr. Vernon, but I'd probably respond most to Carter. There's also an angry monkey that's in the books. And I'm like that a lot, too.
The next question's on your right.
They're so cute, though.
Hi.
Less cute. Just kidding.
I was wondering, what is your favorite joke to tell?
My favorite what?
Joke.
My favorite joke?
Yeah.
Oh, man. You guys just want me to... It's like I'm Jerry Seinfeld or something. Oh, I'm not the best joke teller. A polar bear walks into a bar. The bartender says, hey, polar bear, what can I get you? The polar bear says, I think I'll have a... vodka tonic. And the bartender says, hey, polar bear, why the big pause? Thank you.
Next question up here on your left.
Dad jokes. Just straight up dad jokes.
My name is Zachary, and my question is, which magic trick are you currently working on?
Which magic trick?
Yes.
Well, my buddy Jonathan Baim is here. Jonathan runs a website called theory11.com. You guys should all check it out, but not right now because I'm talking. But it's super great, and there's lots of amazing individual tricks. It's kind of a magic shop in the interweb. And he's been challenging me and trying to teach me new tricks. I'm still working on the invisible deck, which is a cool trick, but I can't remember how it works all the time. Not unlike telling jokes, There might be some people that are like this. If someone starts to tell me a joke, I know it, like I've heard it. But if someone asks me to tell a joke, I got polar bear. That's about all I got. And so if someone says, here, do a trick with a deck of cards, I'm remiss because I don't really have a repertoire. But if someone starts to show me a trick, I go, oh, yeah, I know that one. That's great. Jonathan's trying to help teach me how to do more card tricks. Because there's types of card tricks that are self-working-ish, and then there's types of card tricks that are that require a lot of skill. There's a lot of moves with card tricks. Any magician-ish people in the audience? Not really. Really? You are? How old are you? Nice, dude. 7-year-old magician. Represent. But you can buy card tricks that are simple, and that's great. But you can also learn things, moves like the pass and the double lift and things like that that require a lot of skill. So that's what I want to start learning more, so I don't feel so fraudulent in my life all the time.
Hi, my name is Thais, and hi. I was wondering what it was like preparing and performing the 2013 Tony Awards.
Nice. The Tony Awards are the best show to be a part of. I think they're the best award show to watch. Weirdly, in the same way that I love the opportunity to teach people about magic and how to do magic tricks, I think, I guess I'm a little P.T. Barnum in that I like to show, I like to shine the spotlight onto other people that do amazing things. I just love that stuff. So the Tony Awards is that, right? These people perform to 1,000, an audience of maybe 1,000, and they do it 8 times a week, every week, for a year, if not more. And so they're working so hard, but only a few people are seeing them. And once a year, they get to perform for 1,000,000 people, and they get to do what they do every night and do it at Radio City Music Hall or something. That's just so special to them. They also are supportive of each other in a way that I think the other actor mediums probably are less supportive, and that's not a derogatory thing towards the other industries. It's that the theater people are all together. They all work together a lot. They're in the same zip code, and so they're friends, and so there's a camaraderie there. At the same time, I think it's great that an audience that's at home once a year that doesn't get to go to New York gets for free to see 2.5 hours, 3 hours of great performance after great performance after great performance after great performance. It is an unbelievable show to be a part of. So as the host, it's easy. Hosting the Emmys or the Oscars is so hard because there's little entertainment within the show. It's just a bunch of people accepting awards and awkward pairings of celebrities that walk up and say a line. And that's fine, but it's just, it doesn't have a lot of momentum. But it's easy at the Tonys. So when I got to do the 2013, that was one with a bigger number. And we had gone from... The Tonys had been at a smaller theater in New York for a few years called the Beacon Theater, which was its own magic trick, because the Beacon Theater was a movie house that was in the Upper West Side, not in Times Square. And this Tony's thing is an absolute beast. It's unbelievable because all of these casts of these shows have to be in character, have to arrive, do their show, and then leave in this amazing choreographed thing. And so when we were at the Beacon, it was smaller. There was not much room. Then we went back to Radio City because Cirque du Soleil had a show and their tenure was up. And so we got to do it in Radio City, which is giant. It's the best. It's huge stage. And I just thought, well, there's our opening number. We can talk about how big it can all be. This is the biggest thing ever. And so we asked if the shows that season would want to play, and everyone kind of did. There was a guy named Lin-Manuel Miranda who I had worked with in a couple Tonys in the past. Lin wrote, I had this idea the first Tonys I did. I said, what if we ended the show with an 11 o'clock number? What if we ended the show with a number where I recapped everything that had happened as a magic trick? And the audience would want to stay and watch it because they couldn't believe how did I learn that song when the lyrics were about people who had won and we didn't know who was going to win. So Lin wrote the whole number backstage. And they were sitting backstage watching the show, and then when someone would win or someone would slip or someone would something would happen, then he and Tom Kitt, who was, no, it was Tommy, it wasn't Tom Kitt, it was Tommy Kail, thank you. The two of them would sit there and they'd write and they'd come up with things, and then I split 20 minutes before the show ended and went back and just learned it. We put it in the teleprompter, learned it, and then went out and did the 11 o'clock number, which I thought was cool. So then Lynn... Yeah, it was fun. So that was Lin-Manuel Miranda before Hamilton. And so then I asked if he'd do the opening number. So he wrote Bigger. That was with Tom Kitt. And it was just one of those great things. We rehearsed almost all of that in one day because these people in these shows have to rehearse and be in the shows. And so there was one day when we got everyone and it was in this big dance place. Word recall. Yep, that. And rehearsal space. And it was big. And I walked in, and we'd been working on jokes and all that stuff. And I walked in. Okay, it's opening number, rehearsal. Here we go. And I walk in. There was maybe 500 people there. And all the cast of Pippin. And all the cast of Step Up. And all the cast of... And they were all there in groups. And they had all sort of rehearsed their own thing. And they just sort of... led me by the arm. Hi, this is the cast of Pippin. So hi, here's, and you're going to do this thing, and you'll do this, and you're going to walk that way, and they'll do this all around you, and then you want to jump through a hoop? Okay. And I say, great, so here's how you jump through a hoop. You hold it like this, and you jump through it. And I say, okay, here we go. And I just did that, and then great, thanks. And now here's Mike Tyson. Oh, hey, how you doing? And then here's this. And it was 2 hours of just 500 people, and then you cross your fingers, and it all worked out. It all worked out really well. It's a fun thing to watch. I watch that when I'm crabby. Makes me feel happy again.
Last question.
Okay, from the Magi himself. What's up, 7-year-old magician?
My name is Gabi, and
is that your stage name? Do you have a magician stage name? Are you the great something?
No.
Let's come up with that. Okay, don't yell at me. I'm trying to be your friend here. Let's come up with a cool name together. What should you be? The great Gabatini?
No.
Okay. Gabi the Magnificent? Okay. All right, forget it. What's your question? I don't want to...
I'm doing a school play.
Oh, cool. What's the play?
The Wizard of Oz, and nice. I'm the wizard. Do you have any advice for me?
Yeah, for sure. I do. Have you done plays before?
No.
This is your first play?
Yeah.
And what grade are you in?
Second.
Second grade. Fantastic. So is it just the second grade that's doing this show, or is it the whole lower school? Like first, second, third, fourth graders? Or is it,
I think it's like the whole school.
The whole school. The high schoolers as well?
No. I think it's like fifth through first.
First through fifth? Okay. Yeah. And you got the wizard? Nice job, dude. So here's what you need to do. Memorize your lines, right? And then practice saying them a lot so that you just know them. And practice saying them in different ways. Practice saying them when you're really angry for every line. And then practice saying them quietly. And then practice saying them really fast. And then practice saying them
in the pool.
Yeah. Can I ask you another question, though?
Yes.
What are you nervous about in being the wizard in The Wizard of Oz? What makes you nervous about it? It sounds like you perform magic sometimes, so it seems like you've performed for small groups of people, and you seem cool enough to stand here dressed sharply and ask questions in front of this crowd. So what are you worried about? Are you worried about freezing up and not being able to do it right?
I don't know, because I only practiced 2 times at my school.
When's your first performance? Is it soon? Like tomorrow?
No.
Okay.
I practice on Tuesdays.
You practice on Tuesdays? Okay. Well, I feel very confident for you. I would, you know, if I was going to give advice to you, I would probably give more advice about how you audition to play the wizard in The Wizard of Oz, because that's probably the most nerve-wracking part is auditioning. So if you play, if you do the wizard and you do it and you have a good time and you audition for more stuff, which I think would be cool, just know that a lot of times, and I say this to other kids that want to act, a lot of times you're not going to get the part. Like, a lot of times. The way it works is that a bunch of people come in to try and get the same one part. And a bunch of kids in school will all try to be Oliver. But only one kid's going to get Oliver. And it doesn't mean that if you didn't get that part, it doesn't mean that you did anything wrong or that, that you're never going to want to do it again. I would encourage anyone to not take that personally, because that's the hardest part about acting is the kind of constant sense of rejection or of creating a world where you're only caring about people hiring you or people liking what you do, needing other people to tell you that you're good. If you feel like you're good, then you'll audition for stuff, and if you don't get it, it's fine. There's a bunch of other stuff to do with your day and with your time, and eventually you will get stuff. But I've seen too many people that audition for stuff, don't get it, and then think that they've done something wrong. And that's the worst feeling, especially when it has nothing to do with that. So it sounds like you're on the right path to making, you know, you're already a wizard, for Pete's sake. So I said go there and crush it and have fun. And since you know magic, maybe you can ask the people at school if you can incorporate a little magic as the wizard. Because that's a perfect idea, because he's a wizard and he's behind the curtain, and you could maybe do some, I don't know, some flash paper stuff. Set things on fire.
Why would I do that?
A lighter and any cotton material. No. No, don't play with fire. There's a whole section of magic that's fiery stuff. Don't do that. But you could do some kind of cool magic thing, turn something into something else.
Okay.
Go to a library. Okay, oh, hi.
Okay, I won't do fire.
Okay, thanks. Don't do knife things either. No blades. Maybe go to the library and look up magic books and start figuring out what you want to do as a magician.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, buddy. That was a super fun last question.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was actor, producer, director, and former president of the Academy of Magical Arts, Neil Patrick Harris, whose new book is The Magic Misfits, The Second Story. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Dan Folds, Alex Espelet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.